Well, today's weather made me think of hurricane season, interestingly enough. Sometimes there have been hurricanes or the remains of hurricanes, right, that make their way up our side of the country, and it gets cloudy and rainy for hours and hours and maybe sometimes days and days. And it's a bit like that out there today. Hurricane season doesn't officially arrive here for a few more weeks, but it does look a little bit more like September or October today, maybe, than August. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're along here today. In Lansing, Mayor Virge Bernero says reduced property values since the Great Recession have cost the city about $7 million in lost revenue each year. To avoid potentially massive layoffs in police and fire services, Lansing voters back in 2011 approved a $4 million property tax levy that bolstered funding. The stopgap measure is raised close to $8 million a year. Now the city's asking residents to renew that millage. Last night, the city council approved a measure to put that question on the November ballot. Joining me now in the studio to talk about what impact the millage has on public safety, Lansing Police Chief Mike Yankowski. Welcome back to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
So close to $8 million a year for the last 4 or 5 years for police and fire and for some road maintenance as well. What has that millage enabled your department to keep that it otherwise might have had to let go?
Well, first and foremost, you know, the importance of the millage is to maintain public safety. As Mayor Bonero has stated numerous times, that public safety is the number one goal for the city of Lansing. So that's allowed us to maintain the staffing levels of 202 during that time period. And I think for most citizens to realize that, you know, when you pick up that phone, you call 911, you want the police and fire department to be there as quickly as possible. But you also want us to address those quality of life issues that are so important to our citizens on a daily basis. Without having that extra funding, those type of extra patrols and units would not be possible.
Now 202, would that be the size of the force on a normal, completely funded situation then?
That is the size of our sworn authorized department. So we also have a support staff of almost 38 individuals also. So 202 is our sworn number. Those are the police officers, detectives that run the day-to-day operations on the uniform side.
Tell us here in terms of how important is it in your view that these dollars get reallocated?
Well, again, I think it's important that the citizens know that this is a renewal. So it's to try and maintain our staffing levels that were put into place back in 2011 with the millage at that point in time. So there is no added cost in this renewal of millage. But the importance is it allows us to provide the best possible services to our citizens on a daily basis. You know, units like our community policing unit, which we just renewed and expanded upon our commitment to that, we have 9 community policing officers. We have 3 school resource officers. We've talked about our violent crime initiative, our violent crime impact, and how positive of a unit that is making real progress in keeping our violent crime, our gun violence down in the city of Lansing. Those type of units would be at risk if this millage was not renewed.
Mm. During last night's discussion at the city council, council member Adam Hussein raised a concern about how well the city is informing people about what their money is paying for, or at least preserving. Here's a bit of Adam Hussein from last night.
My concern is essentially, are we compromising our ability to get it passed if we're not sharing with the public on a regular basis, an ongoing basis, what we're actually doing with that millage money? And so again, I raised the point that in 2011, there was a discussion that we might have to lay off 100 police officers and firefighters if this didn't happen. So it did happen. And so what were we able to retain, out of that 100 that we were talking about potentially laying off? And so I discussed the school liaison officers and the community service officers that I know, the positions I know would have been cut had we not passed that. But what are we doing to push that information out to individuals? And I think we can do a little bit better of a job doing that.
Does he have a point, Chief Yankowski? Do you think the city needs to sell the message a little bit better?
Well, I think the message is that for our citizens, there's more to just answering calls for service. And when you look at what's the majority of the police department's funding made up of, 87% of our budget is personnel. 87% of the budget is bodies. So in order to maintain that level of 202, which we have, you know, put in place that we can have those programs that actually build on just answering calls for service, there's so much more to keeping our city safe. We have to have detectives that investigate those crimes. We have to have the school resource officers to help us keep our youth crime down in our schools and around our schools. We have the community policing officers that are there to really engage our citizens. We talk so much about community policing, the ability for a police officer to work hand in hand with its community members to keep our neighborhood safe is critical. And it's programs like that that would be in jeopardy. That's, you know, if you look at, you break down the numbers, that's about 28 positions that the police department would lose. And so that ability to have that quality of life improved, to have those specialties units like the Violent Crime Initiative, which again has focused so much on reducing gun violence here in the city of Lansing, is critical. So it's all about bodies. So that's the majority of where that funding goes for the police department on a yearly basis.
Do you have openings that you haven't filled in the police department right now?
Well, we are currently, I'm pleased to report that we have 15 police officers starting on August 22nd. 8 of them will go to the police academy, the Mid-Michigan Police Academy, and then 7 will go right to our road patrol for training. We are also in the process of completing another interview process, which we hope then will fill those remaining 5 vacancies at that point in time.
So then you'd be fully staffed?
Then we'd be fully staffed. Yeah, we are working very closely with our HR department that we will be fully staffed on the authorized strength of 202 by the end of the year, if not sooner. But again, as always, the Lansing Police Department is constantly hiring and recruiting the next generation of Capital City's finance.
I just wonder, though, if the public, if you're fully funded now and you're unable to keep all of the positions filled open, I'm just wondering if the public interprets that as saying, hey, you know, you're not keeping these positions filled with the money that you've already got.
Well, I think the important part here is that the challenge of hiring qualified police officers in today's day and age has really become a challenge over the last 2 years. So we want to make sure that we're hiring the best and the brightest, trying to fill our diversity needs here within the city of Lansing as a police department, and that we're not just going to hire anyone to be a police officer. That's the commitment that I've made not only to the mayor but to the citizens of Lansing, to make sure that we're hiring the best possible police officers. But I can tell you this, Mark, we are not alone in this. This is a national crisis of hiring police officers in this country. And it's really become a challenge over the last year with all the turmoil that's happened across the nation.
Is it just fewer young people interested in getting into this work?
Less people want to be a police officer, a firefighter, a teacher in today's day and age. For example, when I started over 20 years ago, there was 600 to 800 of us applying for jobs of 1 or 2. We've had less than 50 applying for our positions right now. So general rule of thumb, you have to go through about 10 to 15 people to get one qualified candidate right now.
This November millage would total, this would renew close to $8 million a year, but this isn't all going to the police department. This is also, how much of that is earmarked to police? Is that?
Yeah, 1.5 mils or $2.9 million would be earmarked for the police. Same thing for the fire department, okay. And then the remaining mill would go to the roads and sidewalk repairs is what's being proposed right now. So about $1.9 million for roads and sidewalks, and then $2.9 for police and fire each.
Can you speak to the scenario that faces the fire department here, even in general terms?
Well, again, public safety, right? So we talk about public safety. They're very similar shaped like the police department, that the majority of their budget is for funding of personnel. And so if they were to lose those positions, then we're talking about response times. We're talking about safety. We're talking about medical needs in order to protect life and property, which is, of course, the number one goal, job number one, public safety, as Mayor Bonnero has stated numerous times over his tenure.
We're talking about public safety funding in Lansing. Yesterday, the Lansing City Council approved a measure to put a millage renewal on the November general election ballot. The current millage helps fund police and fire plus road maintenance. My guest is Lansing Police Chief Mike Yankowski. I'd like to shift gears here. The city attorney and the city council are working on a marijuana ordinance. From your position running LPD, what does a marijuana ordinance have to address? What do you consider essential?
Well, I can tell you over the last 2 years, we as a law enforcement agency have been screaming for clarity when it comes to the legislation and laws. So again, when we look at whatever an ordinance, whatever the state law is, we were looking for direction and clarity from any ordinance or any state law that would address the medical marijuana issues. But public safety is our number one concern. So whatever ordinance moving forth, and we're not policymakers. I think it's important to understand that we are not policymakers. We are there to enforce whatever ordinance, whatever law is in place.
But on the ground, what would help you in terms of security, for example?
Well, I can tell you that the Lansing Police Department has been, highly engaged in looking at lessons learned from other states that have legalized marijuana. We have sent a team of officers throughout the entire country to talk about best practices and lessons learned. And I think the three things that come down for us is about regulation, testing, and inspections. Those three categories, I think, are essential for moving forward in any type of future marijuana, medical marijuana legislation, ordinances, state law. Those three things are really the most important. And making sure that, most of these establishments have the security programs, and they have video cameras in place, and they have a trained staff to deal with these issues moving forward.
City Councilman Adam Hussein was on the program 2 weeks ago, and he said that some marijuana businesses in Lansing make a mockery of the law. Does he have a point? Are there some of these places that keep you awake at night?
Well, I can tell you, we have investigated numerous establishments, and when we look at compliance, for the most part, the compliance is there. One thing that I think people forget about is that when we talk about the narcotic issues here in Lansing or even the metro Lansing area across this country, heroin is the biggest issue. We have people dying. We have people overdosing every single day. And I can tell you the number of overdose deaths that we had for marijuana in 2015, zero. 2016, zero. 2014 and on, zero. Heroin last year, 28 deaths. We had over 160 people overdose in heroin. That is our crisis here in the metro Lansing area.
Ingham County has an opioid task force. It's actually meeting again at the end of this month. Do you see that group making progress and getting any kind of results?
Well, we are seeing progress, and I think, the Lansing Police Department is working very closely with that task force. We're actually going to be on a state panel coming up here in October.
Describe the progress.
Well, the progress is this: education, that making people aware that heroin is a real crisis here, not only in Lansing, but across this country, that it's affecting people of all ages, all races, all demographics. The average age of a fatality right now is 41 years old, 44 for overdoses. We've seen as young as 15 and as old as 67 in our fatalities and overdoses. So it really hits a huge, huge population from all walks of life. But it's about educating the public. It's about equipping our first responders with Narcan. And it's about getting people the treatment that they need. And whether it's moms and dads, brothers and sisters, friends, relatives, when they see a problem, they have to take action. And it's a really nasty disease, but we have to educate and we have to use treatment as a way to get ourselves out of this issue. Arresting ourselves out of this problem is not going to happen.
I've heard that this Narcan issue is one of the real linchpins here. Is it getting more of that medication in the hands of first responders? Do you have the access to the Narcan that you need?
We have the access. Between police and fire, for the most part, we're getting Narcan delivered in a quick disbursement that we are saving lives. Last year alone, 300 lives were saved by the use of Narcan by the fire department, the police departments, many
those
police departments.
Those all saved lives?
Those all saved lives. All saved lives. And I think, but the biggest issue is education, counseling, treatment. Those three areas are where we need to focus. And the enforcement piece is not really where we should be focusing. It's about educating, finding treatment and counseling so we can get the help that they need.
Good discussion. We've been talking about public safety here in Lansing. The city council has approved a measure to put a public safety millage renewal on the ballot in November. That funding would help pay for police and fire services in Lansing, as well as road maintenance. We've also touched on a marijuana ordinance and opioid addiction and heroin issues here with our special guest, Mike Yankowski, Chief of Police for the City of Lansing. Chief, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, Michigan's blessed with a lot of water, but how exactly do we use all of it? MLive reporter Garrett Ellison recently took a deep dive into Michigan water use data and made some interesting discoveries. He'll share what he learned coming up. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. 15 years ago, a mid-Michigan journalism veteran decided to take a stab at publishing his own newspaper. Burl Schwartz has been general manager of the State News, the student newspaper at Michigan State University, when he made up his mind to fulfill a long-standing dream to run his own operation. Thus began the free weekly newspaper he called The City Pulse. The City Pulse celebrates 15 years of publication tomorrow with a special issue. Burl Schwartz is here to reflect on those early days of the City Pulse, the 15 years since its founding, and what lay ahead for what he calls the paper for the rest of us.
Mark, it's nice to see you with your clothes on.
Thank you.
Mark and I work out together. you were very kind in your introduction. The truth is, I was out of work. I had to do something. I had to reinvent myself. I had, for personal reasons, a commitment to stay in the Lansing area. And I was talking to a friend of mine on the phone saying, rhetorically, what should I do? And I said, maybe I should start my own newspaper. Mm. And I stopped. I said, that's exactly what I should do. Mm.
When you thought in terms of a mission for the City Pulse, though, how did that take shape?
You know, I've been looking back at our old newspapers as we prepare to publish a special issue tomorrow, looking back at City Pulse, and I came across a mission statement, and it is, and it remains, the purpose of City Pulse is to provide a weekly journal of news and opinion on civic, social, and political issues, as well as arts and entertainment in the Lansing area, supported by advertisers at rates that are affordable to a wide range of businesses and organizations. I couple that with a quote I just came across from a very well-known magazine editor, Terry McDonald from Esquire and Rolling Stone, Sports Illustrated. A magazine always reflects the editor's ego, and the various personas of that editor follow along behind like parade floats.
So that's the case with City Pulse
as
well.
You know, I like political issues, social issues. I come from an era when you afflicted the comfortable, comforted the afflicted, mm-hmm. Sometimes not successfully, sometimes because your editor, the guy you were following along behind, didn't share your views.
Right. How many readers, either of the paper itself or website readers, do you have?
We think we have a pretty good idea because we keep very careful track of how many papers we distribute. So we're distributing over about 21,500 this time of year. That translates into 2.5 readers per issue, according to national surveys of newspapers like ours. So 50,000 readers.
What's your web readership?
I don't know. And that reflects the editor, because I don't really, you know, we have to do the web. and more advertisers are demanding that we sell them ads on the web,
yeah.
You know, but I'm a print guy.
Yeah, the newspaper's motto has always stuck out, a newspaper for the rest of us.
Yeah.
Describe the rest of us. Who is that?
Well, part of that is people
like you, I take it, given what you've
like
already said.
Me. Yeah. You know, it is a motto that's supposed to reflect that we're an alternative. And so you have to be an alternative to something. And when we started, we deliberately were an alternative to the Daily. And it wasn't very hard for somebody from my political ilk to lead an alternative that didn't agree with a fairly Republican editorial page of the Daily in town. So part of it is the rest of us, people who didn't agree with the Lansing State Journal. And some of it is that, hey, you know, there are underdogs, and we try to do stories about people who don't get very much coverage. So that's some of what that motto means.
Burl Schwartz, publisher of the Lansing City Pulse, is our guest here on Current State. The newspaper celebrates its 15th anniversary with a 15th anniversary issue tomorrow. Again, the motto, a newspaper for the rest of us, has sometimes been interpreted as being a gay newspaper. Mm-hmm. You're gay. The paper does cover a lot of topics of importance to the gay community.
I'm
to
gay. What, I to, hadn't heard that.
to what extent is that true?
You know, it is. If you counted stories, as we have sometimes done, we have not had a lot of stories about gay issues. But we have had substantial, important stories about gay issues. But you go back to the very beginning, before we even published, and some of your listeners will remember when Lou Adato was president of the Lansing City Council and got in trouble and eventually had to resign over a charge of sexual harassment. He had an email exchange with the woman that was involved in that issue. And she asked him, what do you know about this new newspaper in Old Town where our first office was? And he said, oh, that's a gay newspaper. And, you know, that was, best I can tell, only because somehow he knew that I was gay. We can't say for certainty how many advertisers didn't advertise with us. We know because we caught him at it that a salesperson for another publication in this town was, by the way, do you know that this is a gay newspaper sort of thing? Mm. We put a stop to it, thankfully, with the assistance of the publisher of that paper at that time. We had an advertiser who hated the other paper in town, started advertising with us in the early days because he wanted to support an alternative to it. He dropped out after a few months. I always suspected it was because I was gay. Years later, his son was on my radio show on The Impact promoting a music series that they were going to do at his dad's bar. And afterward, I asked him, how come your dad quit advertising? And he told me, he said, because you're gay. And he said, that's not a problem anymore. Mm. And I'm glad, you know, I'm glad things changed. Mm.
5 years ago, Burl, you told us that City Pulse didn't have a large enough readership in Lansing's minority population. It was something you said at the time that you wanted to address. Do you think the paper's made inroads with other minorities?
I think we've made inroads, but not enough, quite honestly. A couple of years ago, we hired as an editor a minority, an African-American lesbian, which should have touched a couple of areas for us. But unfortunately, because things didn't work out, she was a fine editor, but things didn't work out. No, we are not nearly as in touch with minority communities as I'd like us to be.
What have been, just from 5 miles up, what have been the biggest challenges keeping the paper going?
Well, you know, the first 4 years, it was a real drain. I did this all out of my own pocket, and it and I was stunned in the fourth year when our accountant said, hey, you got to pay taxes this year. You actually turned a profit. So it took 4 years. And I thought, you know, we were over the hump. And then the recession hit. The biggest, and we managed for most of, from 2008 till now, to turn a profit. 1 year just literally barely. I could probably give you money out of my wallet to cover the profit we turned for that year. But the problem is competing for salespeople. I had a nationally known alternative newspaper consultant come in January. He looked at us very carefully. He said, your only problem is you don't have enough people on the street selling ads. Mm. And part of that, Mark, is we're even though the Daily is much smaller now, those ads it is selling go to a smaller number of salespeople who are making big bucks, and it's very hard to compete with that.
How big is your sales staff?
I have, at the moment, the biggest staff I've ever had. I have 3 1/4 full-time equivalent.
Working sales.
Working just sales. Plus me.
Yeah. The paper is free. Have you considered charging for the paper?
Yeah, that's a model that I am confident won't work and I think contributes mightily to why dailies like the one in Lansing is losing circulation. People simply will not pay in this era of the internet to get their news. So, no, won't work for us.
City Pulse has broken a lot of important stories over the years. Which one or two stand out in your memory?
I'm going to answer that by saying what we could have broken and didn't. One of them is the Ottawa Power Station.
That's courageous.
we were ready to break the Ottawa Power Station and knew this would be a big story, that it was going to be turned into the accident fund, knew it would be a big story, saved calling City Hall until a Tuesday morning. We come out on Wednesday because we didn't want the word to get around. And I think City Hall must have come off its foundation because suddenly we were being begged not to report this story. We didn't know that the very next day was going to be the first day Blue Cross Blue Shield's board of directors would hear about this plan by the parent company to buy this building for the accident fund. Mm-hmm. What we did was a deal. The deal was that we would hold the story. And as long as we were given complete access to the story. Mm. As a result, when everybody came out with the official announcement, we were prepared with all kinds of interviews and did a masterful story.
Mm. You're 69 years of age now. You told us on your 10th anniversary, when you were 64, that you could see 10 more years with the paper. You're halfway between those 10 and 20 year milestones here. Are you thinking about how long you might be publisher of a Lansing City Pulse?
Every 5 to 10 years, it seems like another 5 to 10 years. But I'm reminded. I used to work in Oklahoma City, and the publisher of the newspaper lived 102. His son, who was supposed to take over from him, he was also the owner of the paper, had gone into retirement and came out of retirement when his dad died to run the paper.
It's in your blood.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, we got to have you back and tell the story of interviewing John Lennon in Yoko Ono years ago. I'll never forget the account of that. But we will tease our listeners with the return and to talk about that. Burl Schwartz, owner and publisher of the Lansing City Pulse, the weekly newspaper he's been putting out for 15 years now. There will be a special commemorative issue on newsstands tomorrow. Happy birthday, Burl. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
And coming up on Current State, Scott Pohl takes us on his latest tour of historic Detroit with Jack Dempsey, stopping at a World War I memorial on the University of Detroit Mercy campus. That's coming up after the break. Current state, three times daily on WKAR. Catch us on 90.5 FM every weekday morning at 9 a.m. and every evening at 6 p.m. We're on the air every day at noon on AM 870 WKAR, and we're always at WKAR.org. Every Tuesday, Current State focuses on Michigan's environment. Today, we talk about how the state uses water. It's been a hot topic in Michigan for many years, and not just water from the Great Lakes. The state also relies on groundwater and inland surface water, lakes and rivers, for drinking, manufacturing, irrigation, and other activities. Recently, MLive reporter Garrett Ellison took a close look at statistics about Michigan water use from 2005 through 2014, fully 10 years. The result was his story, Five Factors Driving Michigan Water Use. Garrett Ellison joins me on the line from Grand Rapids. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Before we get into these specific factors driving water use, let me ask you, what made you want to do this story?
Well, a couple of things. one of the factors involved in this was the, as you know, there was the Waukesha diversion application that mm-hmm. was approved for mm-hmm. Wisconsin Town to get Great Lakes water this summer. And the other thing is that we do a regular feature on MLive every Monday. It's called a data mine, in which we take a relevant set of data that doesn't necessarily have a hard news peg or hook, so to speak. And we take a close look at it over the week or two preceding, and we try to analyze it and contextualize it and put it out there for people to sort through and do what they want with it.
To open your story here, you asked readers which Michigan county used the most water during these years, 2005 through 2014, and I'm sure quite a few were way off. Which of Michigan's 83 counties used the most water during those years?
Well, it's the most southwest county in the state. It's Berrien County, which I found to be surprising myself when I found that out.
And Berrien ranks what in the population rankings?
Berrien is 15th in terms of Michigan population. As of last July, at about 150,000 people.
And nine times out of the last 10 years, Berrien County has used more water than any other county in Michigan, and it illustrates one of the key drivers of water use, which is what?
Well, that would be electric power generation. Nuclear, coal, oil, natural gas, you know, what have you, the power plants around the state tend to be located along the coast, and they use a great deal of water, a ridiculous amount of water, you might say. It was 2014 was the most recent data we had. 2015 is still being compiled, but 2014, Michigan used 3.6 trillion gallons of water, and the top five water-using counties were counties with multiple power plants in them, Berrien, Monroe, Wayne, St. Clair, and Ottawa counties. They have either one or several large power plants.
And this is to cool the towers, I take it.
Well, in Berrien, that's primarily the Donald Cook nuclear plant.
Mm-hmm.
It's about one-third of all electricity in Michigan comes from nuclear power, and the Cook plant's the largest producer. It has two operable reactors generating, I'd say, something about 2,200 megawatts at full power. And according to the folks at the plant, the plant pulls in about 1.5 million gallons per minute. And that water condenses steam that's created by the reactor after it exits the turbine generator. Mm-hmm. And so the state has a permit for Cook plant to return all that water back into the lake, but about 12 to 15 degrees warmer. And then the folks at the plant say it never comes into contact with radioactive systems. So.
Well, you said Berrien, I believe you said, was 15th in population. That is not to say that population is irrelevant. Not too surprisingly, Michigan's least populous county, Keweenaw, at the tip of the UP used the least amount of water. So population is clearly a factor, but not the only one, I take it.
Well, no. Population underpins a lot of this across multiple economic sort of categories that the state uses to sort the water use data it gathers. But it's sort of most obvious, population is most obvious in the public supply category because it's a pretty straight correlation there. It's the biggest public supply counties are the most populous, right? And the smallest mm-hmm. are the least populous. Mm-hmm. But since, you know, power plants use water and they send electricity like across county lines, it gets kind of complicated to break down exactly how population affects water usage in the state. You know, among the data set that we analyzed, there was other categories, irrigation, commercial use, and industry. And so there's more analysis to be done there in terms of how population affects water use in sort of latent ways that are hidden among the data set. But for sort of clarity's sake, I stuck pretty much to just analyzing the public supply portion of that.
So far, we've touched on two of the five factors involved in water use that you identified. Electricity, that's what these plants are creating, and population. I'll tick through the other three factors and have you comment briefly on each one of those. They are drinking water, irrigation and industry, and fish hatcheries. First, drinking water. Not a huge surprise there, I guess.
No, not really. When people think about water use and the term use, that's really the first one that they come up with.
Irrigation and industry sounds like it could be significant, but in the 10 years that you looked at, it came in at under 10% of state consumption. Can you put that in some perspective for us?
Yeah, well, I thought that the use, the percentage of use would be higher myself, but that's how the numbers came back. The industries of Michigan, the businesses, farms, parks, and institutions, and these are all categories that are how the state kind of categorizes them. They used about 3.7 trillion gallons between 2005 and 2014, and that was about 9.7% of the state's 38.5 trillion gallon total usage in that period. Of that total, irrigation on farms, parks, golf courses accounted for about 1.3 trillion gallons. It breaks down. It's hard to quantify that breakdown sometimes, but it's such a wide range of potential uses within those categories. Restaurants, hotels, offices, hospitals, schools, ski resorts, water slides. All of that.
Manufacturing, everything, and agriculture, of course. Finally, the one that kind of surprised me, I guess, maybe it shouldn't have, Michigan fish hatcheries. Can you put that into some context?
Yeah. Michigan, the way the state breaks the water use category is down, they pull out livestock as its own category. And I initially looked at that and thought, well, you know, livestock is horses and cattle and hogs and whatnot. But it turns out that fish raised in hatcheries are considered livestock, which, that makes perfect sense. They're alive and they're stocked. But Michigan hatcheries are massive flow-through systems that use a great deal of water. I mean, if you've ever seen one, that's pretty evident.
Yeah.
So that's definitely the main component of the livestock, usage category.
Garrett Ellison has been our guest here on Current State. He's an MLive reporter based in Grand Rapids, and he recently wrote a story, really interesting story, called Five Factors Driving Michigan Water Use. Garrett Ellison, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mark. I appreciate it.
Time for another visit to historic Detroit. Every summer, Michigan Historical Commission President Jack Dempsey takes current state Scott Pohl to several historic sites. Today, that's on the University of Detroit Mercy campus. What took you to the U of D, Scott?
Jack chose the university's beautiful clock tower for this visit, Mark. As you'll hear, it was built to honor those from Michigan who died while serving their country during World War I. Jack Dempsey of the Michigan Historical Commission, welcome back to Current State.
Thank you for having me.
We are standing at the base of the clock tower on the campus of the University of Detroit. And we've chosen this location because we're going to talk about World War I history, and there's a big commemorative plaque on the side of this clock tower marking the University of Detroit's role in World War I. Tell me about this clock tower.
It was constructed, dedicated in the early 1950s, and was a memorial clock tower dedicated to those students of the University of Detroit who gave their lives in World War I, students, individuals from Michigan.
There are 12 names on that plaque, students of the University of Detroit who lost their lives in World War I. It's a beautiful clock tower, and it gives us entree to talk in broader terms about World War I and Michigan's role in World War I. Of course, it wasn't World War I at the time, of course. It was just the Great War and the war to end all wars.
It was, and the war to make the world safe for democracy. It was such a bloody, disastrous conflict with hundreds of thousands of casualties, mostly European, that people thought, surely there will be nothing like this again. And so the remembrance of that kind of 4 years of war played a huge role in the 1920s and 1930s. However, World War II soon erupted and was even more devastating and on a larger scale. But for the generations who experienced the Great War, World War I, for them it was a tremendous tragedy, and those from Michigan who fought, who participated, who served, and who died, they deserved, as this clock tower demonstrates, to be remembered then as well as today.
You've located a book of Michigan history related to World War I that you've had a chance to examine. It's a pretty old book. It came out just a few years after World War I. I'm not sure how readily available this is to the general public, but in your research, what are some of the interesting facts about the role Michigan might have played in the First World War?
Yeah, this book, published by the Michigan Historical Commission and the Michigan War Preparedness Board, probably in the 1920s, indicates that Michigan men and women received over 1,000 military decorations for gallant acts, heroic acts, during World War I. And further interesting, that some two-thirds of those were awarded by foreign nations, that our U.S. Congress authorized those kinds of awards to be received by men and women. And at the end of this volume are listed a number of nurses who served in the European theater and who received various commendations from Great Britain and France. They received these commendations apparently because of heroic acts, bravery near or at the front of the actual battles that occurred in France and on the various battlefields of Europe.
We think of Michigan in World War II, we think of the arsenal of democracy, not just the men and women who served their country during World War II, but how Michigan was involved in building ships and tanks and airplanes for the war effort. How much do we know about Michigan's role in World War I aside from the men and women who served in the war?
One of the most familiar stories, I believe, would be the service of Ernest Hemingway, the famous writer who has tremendous northwestern lower Michigan connections. He served as an ambulance driver, was wounded in World War I, and wrote some very famous works of fiction about that experience. So that's how we've come to know the World War I story from a Michigan perspective primarily, I believe. However, we're actually in the World War I centennial, since it began in 1914. The U.S. participation officially began in 1917, so we're leading up to that.
We're talking with the president of the Michigan Historical Commission, Jack Dempsey, about World War I and Michigan's role in World War I. There's a stretch of highway that is named in commemoration of World War I. I'm not sure people who've heard of it make the connection to World War I, maybe. Tell me about that, Jack.
Most notably on the west side of the state, along the southwestern Michigan harbor town country, is the Red Arrow Highway, named after the Red Arrow Division, a famous division that was in World War I in which Michigan participated. So whether you're traveling here over on the east side of the state or on the west side, hopefully when you pass these sites, you'll think of those Michiganders during the 1917-18 time frame who put their lives on the line for our country, for our liberty.
And you've reminded me that World War I is where the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery began. That was the first unknown soldier, was from that war.
In the 1920s, that idea of creating a memorial to an unknown soldier to remember all of those who were lost, especially those who could not be identified, was created. And so it's become really part of our national military heritage, I think, that everyone salutes, that there's this Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery across the Potomac River from the nation's capital, began because of a World War I soldier. And we can bring it to the current day when just recently in Detroit, in a city of Detroit warehouse, four World War I artillery shells were found. Somehow they'd been stored there for years, and the building had to be evacuated. The bomb squad, I guess, had to come in and make sure that those shells were not live. So some almost 100 years later, we still have those kinds of experiences that remind us that there was this actual conflict and Michigan played a role, participated in that great war.
And Jack, you have a family connection to World War I. Tell me about that.
My grandfather served in the U.S. Navy. He was born up in the UP, Calumet, and so made a long journey all the way to France on a ship and served honorably. And there, again, we look at Michigan's maritime heritage, and here's an individual who grew up and ended up in the U.S. Navy in World War I serving his country.
You know, it's hard to believe that a war of the stature of the First World War, in a lot of ways, is the overlooked war. We had World War II, of course, the Greatest Generation, and rightfully so, we've given them a great deal of attention in recent years, especially as some of the older men and women who served in World War II have begun to pass and visit the memorial that has been constructed in Washington to World War II. We've had Korea, Vietnam, the wars in the Middle East. We don't think about World War I very much, and this being the centennial year, I'm glad we've had an opportunity to revisit Michigan's role in World War I.
Hopefully also the legislature will enact legislation to create a Michigan World War I commemoration commission to have that kind of effort so that we can remember the service of those soldiers. And it's really important that we remember each generation and each individual, soldier, nurse, whatever, someone who from a patriotic standpoint wanted to serve their country. I'm mindful of how a member of Michigan's National Guard after 9/11 during that succeeding decade had been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, came back and said that soldiers feel like most Americans have no idea of the burden that our armed forces and their families have carried. So it's important that we tell today's soldiers, today's personnel who are serving our country in that kind of capacity, that we will not forget their service, whether it's this current war against terror, as it's called, or again, or World War I, and going back to that those days of great bloodshed.
At the base of the clock tower on the campus of the University of Detroit, built to commemorate U of D students who lost their lives during World War I, I'm talking with the president of the Michigan Historical Commission, Jack Dempsey. Jack, always good to see you.
It's been an honor. Thanks.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Wednesday on Current State, drive down Grand River in Okemos or Marsh Road in Okemos and Hazlitt and you see the signs, Stop Cata's BRT. That's the bus rapid transit line that's been taking shape in recent years. We'll ask two Meridian Township residents why they oppose the $140 million BRT, one of them, Township Clerk Brett Dreyfus. Also, spoken word music falls somewhere between hip-hop and rhythm and blues. A new recording project has brought some Lansing artists together. It's called Speak Life, the Spoken Word Collection, Volume 1. Current State Scott Pohl talks with the man behind the project, Tyler Jensen. And what began as a residential camp for troubled boys in Ingham County in 1962 is now a multi-purpose human services organization, which every year gives more than 8,000 people the resources they need to turn their lives around. For Neighbors in Action, we'll speak with the CEO of Highfields Incorporated, as well as a Highfields client involved in one of their programs. All of that and more. Coming up Wednesday on Current State, our executive producer is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. Don't forget the Current State podcast. It features everything that we do here on the radio program every day, anywhere, anytime. Find the Current State podcast at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you find podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. We hope you can join us tomorrow. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Thank you.